Now, where does this solar system form? Where do these comets come from and things like that? Well, that's not an unreasonable question, and I think it's quite reasonable that we can look at, now that we understand about comets quite a lot, we understand an awful lot about meteorites, the compositions of meteorites. It's quite reasonable, with specimens right here in the lab, to analyse them and to make reasonable inferences on what they may, the temperatures at which they formed, the sort of conditions within they formed in our nearby visible universe, the one where, you know, like Voyager went to Jupiter, it's very reasonable, Saturn, and getting those images that are sent back to Earth from those distances. They're the sort of technology that we need, and that's the thing we can sort of have reasonable confidence in. Well, I think that the idea is the Sun, as I said, formed within its own region. There was the perhaps a pre-solar cloud at one stage. The Sun was once an interstellar cloud. It would have cooled down. A lot of the gas can't condense, like the hydrogen and helium, but there's a lot of comets could condense. And I think comets actually form from myriads of little grains that settled out in the pre-stellar cloud. So this is long before the Sun formed its sort of Laplacian nebula. There was this very cold, tenuous pre-solar cloud, and comets accreted within that and then started to rain out onto the Sun. And in fact, a lot of these comets got together right at the centre of the pre-solar cloud to form a great nucleus, maybe up to 1 or 2% of the solar mass. And this nucleus, once it becomes sufficiently compressed, then attracted the rest of the gas down. And I think that's how star formation is triggered, through accretion onto cometary cores. I put forward that idea quite a few years ago in connection with what's called the solar neutrino puzzle. It's believed the Sun, you know, has a shortage of neutrinos. Anyway, comets like Halley, I believe, were formed out in the interstellar medium. They're very loose, fluffy sort of things. We saw that with the breakup of the Shoemaker-Levy. They don't have much mechanical strength, and the gravity out there in the pre-stellar clouds is very weak. The stuff just comes together, and more or less you just get very simple sticking of grains together, more or less cohesive strengths holding them together, and surface tension and the like, electrostatic effects rather than much gravity. The gravity's a bit weak. But at the centre of the Sun, there would be a great swarm of comets which got there in the beginning. Of course, they've long since melted, and these comets are, you know, would have sublimed, and then, but they would have enriched the centre of the star with lots of carbon and nitrogen. And the early Sun would have burned quite fiercely in the beginning and possibly burnt out its central store of hydrogen and helium. And that's why I think there are very few neutrinos inside the Sun. They're coming out because it's all burnt out. And then the rest of the Sun, a big cloud that was once there, that would have proceeded to have tumbled in on top of this cometary core, and a huge cloud extending way out, and initially out beyond the orbit of Neptune, a great slowly spinning cloud. Anyway, according to the Laplace's nebula hypothesis, the solar system would have formed from this Sun, would have been a great large cohesive cloud, slowly settling out of the interstellar medium, spinning and then casting off a family of gas rings. And then the planets, each planet formed in situ from each gas ring, and there's a marvellous focusing effect that takes place as a result of these gas rings. And remember that early slide I showed of showing how far apart the planets are. The distances are enormous. I mean, it's bad enough for us to come out tonight on a wet night out into the provinces of, is it Moorabbin? We're not at Moorabbin, are we? Yes, Moorabbin. Actually, I was thinking of Mordialloc, but that's somewhere else. And imagine, you know, the huge distances you'd have to travel to a meeting on Neptune or something like that. It's just phenomenal how the concentrated that mechanism was. It's shown in this slide as well. And so I believe the gas rings are the way to go, and the way you form gas rings is actually through supersonic turbulence. This is the driving mechanism. There are these things called T Tauri stars. If you study them, they seem to exhibit these very violent outbursts at their surfaces, evidences of very powerful convective storms, and this gas pressure, in addition to the normal gas pressure, you've got the turbulent stress due to these rising and falling convective currents. And this convective stress greatly expands the outer regions of the cloud, and it gives it a great cohesion. You can see an artist's montage here of these convective storms. It's actually not as meant to be as active as that. They're meant to be restrained within the cloud, but that's sort of what the early sun would have looked by, you know, if it looked with all these convective storms. And anyway, it turns out the inclusion of the turbulence pushes the outer layers outwards, and as I've explained at earlier meetings of the ASV, I've had a very long association with the Astronomical Society, and I think Vince is representing them tonight with his good lady, Philomena, I think, is it correct? And they have, in fact, endorsed all aspects of the modern Laplacian theory, and the Society there's some sort of intergalactic wiggle there. And you can see here the effect of including turbulence drastically lowers the moment of inertia of the cloud. The cloud becomes very concentrated. Published this about 20 years ago, and it allows the cloud to contract from the orbit of Neptune to its present size, getting rid of nearly all of its angular momentum with hardly losing any mass. The amount of mass you lose is proportional to F, the moment of inertia factor, which is about 0.01. So you lose about, each gas ring, you lose about a third of 1%, it turns out, of mass. And in the beginning, as I said at the start of this talk, the Sun's original mass may have been as much as 20% larger than it is today. But the Sun was able to contract all the way from Neptune to its present size, losing up only 20% of its mass, but nearly two orders of order of magnitude of angular momentum. So it's a very efficient mechanism once you get this supersonic turbulence for getting rid of angular momentum. And Laplace envisaged that there'd be a coalescence of fluid, but planets that we know aren't really wholly made of fluid. But it is true that this supersonic turbulence embraced with the Laplacian model, you can actually correctly account for the observed mass and angular momentum distribution within the solar system. And that has been the main point that I have made to my colleagues over the last few years, the main point behind supersonic turbulence. And the reason, I think 2 years ago, John Maddox rejected one of my papers then, he said, because no one would believe in supersonic turbulence. But he did suggest that I get, maybe that, you know, the story wasn't over. And when I spoke to him on Friday, I told him it certainly wasn't over. And I had, in fact, I have a large ARC grant, and I have a very good student who's been working on this for 2 years now, and I've sent him, he's going again to America this year to work at the High Altitude Observatory at this National Center for Atmospheric Research. We've actually found you do get supersonic turbulence, and actually it does produce, it gives the cloud the very features that are required for it to throw off these gas rings and become very centrally condensed. We made that discovery last year and presented it in a meeting in Washington in October. And I'll talk more about Chris Deitt's work shortly, but we've now confirmed that the supersonic turbulence does in fact cause the cloud to adopt this very centrally condensed profile. And it took a long while to set this code up. It's a very complicated numerical code for solving these differential equations, and it's highly non-linear, and you need a huge number of cells and a large number of processors working simultaneously to solve it. But it does seem as if the supersonic turbulence is the way to go. And that, I regard that'll be one of my sort of main contributions to science, will be the recognition that there's supersonic turbulence. Did play a vital role in the formation of the solar system. Fortunately, despite the savaging, I suppose would be the best description over the years, I've received not only from people like Maddox, and others. He's only pales into insignificance compared to some of the tyrants operating on the U.S. circuit. One only has to mention the Cornell Mafia, for example, the home of Icarus. These guys should be brought to account at the Hague, the International Court of Justice, for their crimes. I used the theory, despite its apparent weaknesses at that time, to, as you know, and in fact my last meeting delivery to this group, the Space Association, was in fact after the Uranus encounter, where I'd used the model to predict new moons of that planet. In fact, they did find quite a few new moons inside, a pack of them at 2.5 radii and a big one at radius 3.5 that I had actually predicted back in 1977. And that was a successful confirmation of the model. And you also know, of course, in 1989 there was the Voyager encounter at Neptune, another situation where you're getting further away from the Sun and one's pre-existing knowledge is even more shaky than the knowledge that one has prior to that point, and one has to be very cautious about making speculations. But as I said, this contribution of the supersonic turbulence that I've made did suggest that Neptune should be surrounded by a family of hitherto unknown moons between Neptune and Triton, which orbits at 15 radii. There should be a swarm of blokes in about here, somewhere between about 2 and 5. Now, I published a good paper in Japan at the time with the assistance of Charles Morgan, who's actually a correspondent for a couple of journals in Japan, and he translated it all into Japanese and put this prediction into place before the encounter, that there'd be these four large moons. And sure enough, in fact, that was confirmed, as you know, that the Voyager found these four moons, and they were pretty well within a few percent of the predicted positions. And that sort of demonstrated the quantitative capability of this modern Laplacian theory. Here's the largest of these moons, called Proteus, and it's about 400 kilometres across. It's very dark, its reflectivity. It only reflects about 6% of the light it receives. You can't see it from Earth. And just like we were saying at the start of this talk, that these UCLA blokes are claiming, you know, there aren't any Jupiters out there around other stars. Our solar system's unique because we've got a Jupiter, and you need to have a Jupiter to allow, you know, protection from comets and stuff. And therefore, because these other solar systems don't have Jupiters, they don't have these big broomsticks out there to defend the littlies on their own planets. These little frogs are only barely jumping two paces and they get zapped by some nasty meteorite. And so therefore, we're very lucky. We live on possibly the only solar system in the galaxy. And look how well we're managing our solar system. Yes. Look how well we treat our, you know, neighbours and things like that. And our members of our scientific community, how well we embrace their ideas. Yes. Oh, you can record all of this, Andrew. These moons are very dark because they've got a lot of carbon on them. That's another thing that spins off from the model. I actually predicted this, that there'd be all this carbon out there. And it has been detected. They have a very flat reflectivity observed on these satellites out at Neptune. And a lot of CO2 ice, too, is out there as well. A lot of dry ice is another one of my predictions. And sure enough, if you look at Triton, it has a lot of dark patches on it. It's the pure carbon. And then you've got all this dry ice. And in fact, that was announced 2 years ago, the discovery of a very rich bed CO2 ice. And I think it's a considerable triumph for this modern Laplacian theory, because not only is it able to sort of face up to and successfully give an explanation of the mass distribution of the solar system, it also makes predictions for the existence of new moons, And also in this more recent chapter that I've embarked on, I've had to become a sort of chemist, and the model is able to predict the compositions of these objects. And the next phase of my research, in fact, will be to give you an accurate tally of the chemistry of every planet in the solar system. And there will be spacecrafts that can actually check this out. But there are only 24 hours in the day, you know, and you can't sort of get it all done. And on that fine note, I'm going to stop.